Stephen Amsterdam, it is a great pleasure to have you here with your book, The Easy Way Out, which is not easy by any means. I'm presuming this is an ironic title, but yeah. I think it's a fabulous, fabulous read. So congratulations.
Thank you.
How long have you been a palliative care nurse?
6 years now.
And how have you combined writing with being a palliative care nurse? Because we had Jacinta Halloran in here recently, and of course she's a doctor as well as a novelist, and she finds that the two things are very compatible. Are your two professions compatible?
The nursing agency I work with, the nursing practice I work with, makes it compatible, because I work between 0 and 3 shifts a week. And the other days are writing days, and so it's actually a pretty good balance, except for the past 4 years where normally with palliative care you'd like to do something that's a little bit of a relief on the other days. This book has not necessarily been that.
No, exactly, which goes back to the irony of the title. So tell us a little bit about why the book is called The Easy Way Out and what it's about.
There was a bit of a discussion with publishers along the, and the agent did not like that title. It was Quality of Life for a little while, and I was like, no, that's not. I just wanted to unpack this topic as well as I could. And
so assisted dying.
And I mean, really, there's no easy way out. And it's how do we get to a better understanding? And really, I wrote the book I wanted to interrogate the topic, if you want to put it that way. That I just really wanted to see what are the options.
Okay, so it's interesting that in doing that, you've chosen to be a little bit speculative in that the book is not set absolutely now. There are a few references to things that suggest that we are in a sort of not too distant future, like the fact that Evan, our central character, who is the assisted dying nurse, has a mother, Viv, who we'll talk about in a moment, and Viv has a chip in her. She's been diagnosed with Parkinson's, but at the moment we know that dogs have chips, but we don't yet have people with chips.
They do.
They do? People have chips?
At nursing homes. This is a
they
real,
do?
This is a true thing for like 5 years.
You're kidding me. Okay, well, never mind. I didn't know that. I'm reeling from the shock of that. But the point is, why did you decide that you would set this book in a kind of semi-speculative future?
There are a lot of things that I don't have to answer for in a speculative future, and a lot of things you can do. You've got a kind of a bigger budget with your imagination, if that makes sense. Like, you can do more stuff.
Yeah.
And the chip is not a shocking thing in that world. It's a believable thing in that world, but it is, in fact, it's a real thing already. I think I like speculative. I mean, ultimately, all fiction is speculative. What would happen if... So I really just wanted to see how far I could picture it by not anchoring it in our present, in our place. I just have more freedom.
So basically it means, it gives you a little bit more sort of latitude, but it's still anchored very much in the attitudes that we have. The taboo around assisted dying is still there. And so the project that Evan is involved in a hospital is still kind of on the fringe. It's kind of hush-hush, it's a pilot. It's not yet part of the mainstream role of the hospital to help people to die.
No, when I first started the book, I was really picturing what would the bureaucracy be like, and probably wrote too much on this topic, but there would be politics about where this would take place in a hospital, if it's going to take place in a hospital. So, you know, I've worked in a psychiatric ward, and that's always kind of in the quiet part of the hospital. People shouldn't get too close to that. And so I assumed it would be hidden.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about Evan, about who he is and about his life as a nurse and what you think his motives are.
Motives. Yeah, I mean, he's been sort of the most complicated character I've had to write, because I really couldn't imagine this job for myself. So I wanted to see who would do this job, what would their backstory be, what would challenge them, what were his moral...
That's completely fascinating to me, because I'm assuming that you wrote this character because you could identify with him, because your job as a palliative care nurse would mean you would have total sympathy for the kind of role that Evan plays.
No. My story is that, of course, in palliative care, this comes up. people say, can we just cut to the chase here in some format of that? And I have to say, well, legally, no. But let's talk about what's going on for you, and let's see what we can do for symptom management or, you know, family stresses. And normally palliative care can do a lot. In the city, at least, palliative care can be really good. But, and part of me feels like, I wish there was something I could do. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just go back to the car and get some drugs and I'll be right back. And there'll be a law. I'm convinced of that. That's not far off.
Yeah.
But I'm also glad that's not my job.
Okay.
No idea. So I did not come to this book with answers. I just want to see, okay, what would it be like? Because this would be and will be somebody's role.
And what's wonderful about what you do is that you test Evan with various different scenarios within the hospital context. He's got very strict sort of parameters and very strict protocols around him, as he should. And then there's a bit of a stumble and he kind of goes freelance, and he's presented again with a different variety of cases, as it were. So what are you doing there with each individual case that we come across in the novel? What are you showing us?
That it's complicated. Mm. That everybody's got different boundaries on what's active assistance, what's passive assistance, and how close does it get to you before you're involved, and what does it feel like to be involved in a responsible way? So I really just wanted to test. It's exactly what you said. I wanted to test him and break him. Like, that's the author's job.
Oh, you're so cruel. Now, I'm very intrigued, as many readers will be, by Evan's private life away from the hospital. You've given him this really intriguing arrangement where he's part of a very loose, casual ménage à trois. Mm. Tell us a little bit about Evan's other world, other life.
Well, it sounds a little calculating to say I devised Evan, but at kind of figuring him out, I was like, okay, what is his romantic history? How close has he gotten to other people?
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, you know, this might be an arrangement that he could stomach. Like, there's less responsibility for him in this situation. So
it's him and two guys.
Yeah.
And they just, basically, they meet for sex.
At the beginning, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's trying to figure out how close he can, you know, what he deals with, you know, that they see the relationship as a little bit differently than he sees it.
Mm.
And so as that develops, that also tests him and pushes up against his self.
And then the other way that he's tested is in his relationship with Viv, his mother, who is a fantastic character. Where on earth does she come from and what does she represent?
It's interesting. I was contacted recently by somebody who's organizing a panel I'm doing, saying that, you know, that character and that relationship is so firm just before, you know, talking to you. Is this related to you and your mom? Not at all. Where does she come from? I just wanted to make her like a no bullshit, older, sick person.
But they have a past.
Not the quietly fading.
She's kind of not conventional, so you might just want to say something about the fact that there's been a period on a commune, hasn't there? And
yep.
There's a little bit of a relationship with gambling.
A little bit of a relationship with gambling, but she's got it under control mostly. But I get to see this in my work, but older people are not, in real life, are not older people on The Simpsons. Older people have more depth. Older people have more texture mm-hmm. than they frequently do. And, I mean, she's not that old. I think she's mid-60s, 60, mm-hmm. 68. But trying to figure out how to show her and how she would respond to the indignities of being sick. And how she would fight back, and, you know.
Can I just pick you up on something there?
Please.
I find that word indignity really interesting. My mother-in-law died last week, and before she died, thank you, we talked a lot about dignity and what dignity meant to her in the hospital context. And she said, when you're in pain, your dignity doesn't matter to you at all. Mm. And she sort of made me think that dignity is this kind of very middle class sort of bourgeois notion that we have, that, you know, you have to preserve the dignity around, say, your control of your bodily functions at all price. But in fact, when push comes to shove, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, in a hospital, your ass is showing, essentially, at all times. So the dignity does go. And
do you think that we place too much value on dignity?
That's a great question.
And that it's misplaced and we should be thinking about other things?
Mm. Yes, in short, dignity is overrated. And I think that's, you know, I really don't come down on one side or another on the topic of assisted dying. The thinking of the writer Karen Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you read her?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Her quarterly essay, and she is vigorously against assisted dying.
And she says in that essay, you know, much like birth, death doesn't happen on schedule. It's messy. It's not comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's part of who we are. And of course, you know, birth has been medicalized quite a bit too. But the idea of cutting it short just because it's inconvenient or uncomfortable, let's keep track of what we're losing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the ethical slippery slope on that is very slippery indeed. When I was reading you, I kept thinking that you had the same moral toughness and moral grasp and irony, because there are moments of great black comedy in this book.
Yes.
Of Lionel Shriver. Is Lionel Shriver a writer that has been an inspiration to you, or if not, who are the writers that you look to?
My life was passing before me when he brought up her name. I've only really read We Need to Talk About Kevin,
right,
and some of the Post-Birthday World, which I did not finish for some reason, but it's not because I didn't like it. It got misplaced. She's not the one that comes to mind.
Okay, so who does?
Who does?
Who are the writers that you look up to or that have been role models for you or have been important in your kind of writing life? You look really stuck there.
I mean, I'm thinking of the writers that I love and their economy and the stories they tell, but I'm not thinking of people who you know, taken on a topic like this, mm-hmm, or anything like that. What I'm thinking of at the moment is Maggie Nelson's The Argonauts, which I read after this book was well and truly written, but just someone who's speaking as clearly as she possibly can, which is in some ways the opposite of fiction. Fiction is like devising a puzzle, mm-hmm, for people to understand what you're talking about, and Maggie Nelson is trying to be as lucid as she can be on a topic, which is always a problem I have with fiction, is it seems, you know, you're just playing three-card Monty with people to try and get them to guess what you're thinking. I'm thinking of Truman Capote, In Cold Blood,
mm-hmm,
which even its publishing history has irony to it. Who else?
Well, those are two good ones for us to kind of, you know, stick with or start with anyway.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the fact that you say that you don't come down on one side or on the other, because I did see this book as being a book that was advocating for assisted dying. I want to know, just going back to your life and your work as a palliative care nurse, what is the thing that gives you the greatest amount of satisfaction about that work?
And, it's almost trite to say the word privilege about the work, but coming into people's lives, what the incredibly vulnerable moment, coming into a family's world, being trusted and being allowed to help and being able to help.
What led you there though, Stephen? I mean, it's all very well to say it's a privilege now that you're there and you're experienced, but you are also dealing with sorrow and grief and pain and suffering. What in your life gave
what did this to me?
The fortitude to think that you could withstand what goes with this job?
I often ask that question because I look around the table at Handover and I was like, what happened to each one of us that got us here? I don't know about the other nurses. I think one thing that I like about this kind of, I mean, I like nursing because it's scientific. I thought about social work and I thought that's going to be too soft for me. And I like that, you know, okay, there's this pain, this kind of pain can be treated with this sort of drug. That's sort of the nuts and bolts part of it. But the sorrow and grief in sitting with that, to me, it's of a piece with getting to know people. And for me, as I think there, for lack of a better word, palliative care has a narrative. And so getting to know people. Mm. And there are different, you know, oncology patients get to know their carers. And ditto psychiatry. You get to know, there's a relationship that builds. It's not always a perfect relationship, but it's a relationship. As opposed to, you know, I was never going to be a theater nurse because the patients are unconscious.
Yeah.
I was never going to be cardio because it's parts. They come in, they get a stent, they go. It's like a garage mechanic. I want that connection. So, you know, I get something from that.
Yeah, I get it.
Okay, so that leads me to ask, I have to ask you then, given that the characters that you test Evan with in the novel are so diverse, you have to pick one and tell me who's your favorite that he helps to die. You do.
Well, I mean, Sanford, just because I spent a lot of time on him. And it was weird because as I was writing him, he started to sound a little bit like Donald Trump. Because certainly in the editing process in the last year, and I was not thinking about Donald Trump when I first came up with him, but it's just a sort of like kind of piggish,
brash
businessman who...
And he's used to getting his way.
Yeah. A little not worried about political correctness. And he's just a little bit rough on the edges. And he tests Evan quite directly.
Mm-hmm. But he does also have that sort of slightly flamboyant, show-offy kind of nouveau generosity of, you know, go to my favorite restaurant, order yourself a steak, I'll foot the bill. You know, there's a bit of swagger there as well.
I like to have a breakfast buffet in a book. I think every book should have one.
Do you? Yeah, well, I think he's my favorite character in the book, too, of the people who are choosing to die.
I like them all, really. Yeah.
Well, how could you not? They're all wonderfully drawn. Andrew Denton has been very vocal in campaigning on this particular issue of assisted dying. And I just wonder whether you are concerned about whether your book will be used to further the argument, given that you say that you haven't come down on one side or the other. Are you ready for the intensity of the public debate that a book like this can generate?
No. People have been saying this to me for the past few weeks, are you ready for this? And I'm like, ready for what? I think, you know, you start a book 4 or 5 years ago, and then suddenly it comes and my publisher who's sitting out there said, you know, when he acquired it, he said, will you forgive me for saying that this topic is hot? And you don't know how it's going to hit. And you don't know how people are going to read it. And I think I was very gratified with the review the other day.
Oh, you got a stunning review in The Age.
That it was read the right way. And I really worked hard on trying to get as open a reading as possible. And I think it does, ideally becomes a bit of a Rorschach, what you take away with it. And I think actually all my books have a Rorschach quality that I can sort of ask somebody, what did you think about the ending? And then I find out exactly how they read it. And it's, however it's used, it's beyond me as a very, what's the word?
Precocious.
Precocious, thank you. That's the question, that's the word. Said, what do you have to say about the death of the author? And I was like, I'm here doing a school talk. That's what I have to say about the death of the author. But I can't anticipate how it'll be read.
Well, all I can say to you is get ready, because I think, you know, you're going to have a very, very deserved amount of attention for this book, which I think is really outstanding, and I'm sure it's going to win something major. Thank you very much for coming in today, Stephen Amsterdam.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.